Hello, I'm Dan Masterson, host of Strategy Talk. With me today are Al Nofi and Jim Dunnigan. Al is a military historian and contributor to strategypage.com. Jim is a military analyst, consultant for the U.S. military, and well-known author. On Strategy Talk, we discuss current events with our own unique twist. We report news as history. Jim and Al, we'd like to talk a little bit about the naval force structures today. I know this has been an ongoing debate in proceedings, the United States Navy Institute's publication, is between the blue water and the littoral forces. Maybe, Al, you could define for us what littoral means to get us started.
Well, basically, if you divide the watery parts of the planet into blue, green, and brown, the blue is the offshore waters, the deep waters, the oceans and the seas. The green is the coastal areas where the water is rather shallow. You may not be able to operate submarines, for example, with modern technology. And then the brown is going into creeks and rivers and coastal inlets and whatnot, where you have almost no depth, for operations. And of course, we've operated at all three environments. Although historically, the Navy has not liked the green and blue mission.
Right. In fact, the brown water missions sometimes have been carried out by the Army, correct?
Yes, that's true. The Army quite often had, during the Civil War, for example, a lot of the gunboats operating on the Mississippi River were actually owned by the Army.
Right.
The Army traditionally, during wartime, built their own fleet from scratch. I mean, as Al and I pointed out in our book on the War in the Pacific, the Army actually had more ships during World War II, a larger fleet, so to speak, in terms of ship count, than the Navy. But the Navy had far more tonnage. Most of the Army ships were coastal ships, some used for patrol. My father, for example, was in the Army, but he spent about 6 months as a radio man on a Army PT boat, which was being used for air sea rescue off New Orleans. The Army had ships for its logistical purposes. I don't think they had any warships aside from the machine gun on my father's PT boat. But the Navy has, over the last, since World War II, they've come to realize that if they want the brown water mission, they better, get onto it before there's a war.
Right. Now, what has caused the debate over the last few years that we see in the military press, Jim?
Some of this is culture. The Navy's Bible is Mahan, Influence of Sea Power on History, and dominating the seas is the most, command of the seas is the most important mission, and so on. So the Navy keeps thinking about the possibility of the so-called peer competitor, someone who can come out there and go toe-to-toe with us in a new midway or something. And we wants to maintain the large surface, the large oceanic war fleet to ensure that we can completely control the seas. The problem is that since the end of the Second World War, aside from the Soviets, whose probable wartime experience would have been exciting and short, all of our war actual military commitments have seen very little. The only role that the oceanic fleet has performed is in supporting the mission ashore. They had battleships that were designed to blast away at each other, and aircraft carriers that were designed to do midways, striking land targets. And you had Navy guys performing inshore missions up creeks and rivers in Vietnam, for example. So this is where the debate comes in. Those people say, we have to be ready for the big mission, and the people who say, well, there isn't going to be another big mission. Now, the real solution to this, of course, is the compromise position, and that is that how can we be ready for the big mission and at the same time be ready for the more likely mission? So there's a tension here.
Yeah, World War II changed everything, and a lot of admirals and Air Force generals have a hard time, you know, adjusting to it. What happened after World War II? Well, basically three things. First of all, the Army became a major peacetime service. Before World War II, the Navy was the big peacetime service. More money was poured into the Navy than the Army because they were building these huge, expensive ships, which required, you know, fairly sophisticated sailors to operate, especially since the steam Navy. Secondly, the Air Force and the Navy, after World War II, were dominating their spheres. You know, the Air Force has had air domination since World War II. You know, the Russians challenged it a little bit, you know, in theory during the Cold War, but basically the Air Force is the victim of its own success. The Navy, which people tend to forget, is in the same position. We still talk about Britannia ruled the seas for several centuries. Well, since World War II, arguably since the end of World War I, it's the American fleet which has dominated the oceans, and this is a liability in some respects, and especially now, because whenever there's fighting to be done, it's soldiers who are getting killed and wounded and suffering. And that's become generally accepted now, even by the admirals and the Air Force generals.
Yeah. And, of course, you have a problem because the Navy has built up a large constituency that thinks in terms of the Great War. I mean, you regularly see, oh, my God, the fleet is the same size as it was in 1930. Well, in terms of the number of ships, that's true. And in 1930, you know, people weren't terribly upset with that, even though, like, the British fleet was even larger and the Japanese was 60-something or 70% of ours. They thought, that was sufficient. The ships were smaller. I mean, the total tonnage of the fleet today is humongous compared to what it was in those days. And there are actually four times more people in the Navy than there were in those days.
It's a much more powerful Navy, relatively speaking.
An infinitely more powerful Navy. I mean, in those days, we were the second most powerful Navy in the world, arguably, possibly the first. And we had the Japanese pushing close behind. I mean, today, all the rest of the world, navies in the world, barely make a good second.
Yeah, in How to Make War, I do that calculation of all the world's navies, and I crunched the number several different ways, but just about every way I did it, the U.S. Navy came up with about half or a little more of the world's naval combat power when you take into account quality. And it's just an overwhelming, you know, preponderance. And when you add in American allies, I mean, Britain still has a, you know, significant fleet, although it's puny compared to the American fleet. The preponderance is just overwhelming. Nobody can touch us. You know, people talk about the Chinese threat. Well, warn your great-grandchildren.
Right. Now, the thing is, with the U.S. Navy, a lot of our tonnage is in aircraft carriers right now, correct?
Yes.
And what, Jim, I think you've been writing about what they're thinking about cutting a couple of the aircraft carriers now.
Well, another revolution in military affairs, as they like to say down in D.C. The smart bomb, the GPS-guided bomb, and smart bombs in general, they've sort of been sneaking up on. That's something else. My dear old dad, this is why I'm in this business. At the last year of his Army service, he got assigned to work on smart bombs. And I first found out about smart bombs, you know, when I was a little kid. I didn't know what the hell he was talking about. But these were the first, you know, guided bombs. When these were perfected, and one can say that happened in the 1980s, when the 1990s, when the GPS bomb, you know, came into use, yeah, that changed everything because all of a sudden, you know, you could basically take out one target with one bomb. Well, one target with two bombs to be absolutely sure, because a small percentage of the smart bombs don't work, which is normal. So it doesn't pay to have, you know, two bombs on the target just to be sure. But in the past, you basically required hundreds of bombs to take out the target. You know, the rule of thumb in World War II was, you know, and this is with the most modern, you know, bomb sites, the Norden bomb site and what have you, it basically took 300 bombs. It was a little less than that if you came in with a fighter bomber, you know, basically on the deck, where you basically dropped the bomb very close. And indeed, after the Vietnam War, actually, no, by the 1980s, 1990s, they came in with new computer assisted, you know, bomb sites for the fighter bomber pilots. And you might say a dozen bombs, you know, to be absolutely sure you actually hit the target. Now it was down to one or two. This changed everything because an aircraft carrier is limited by the number of sorties it can generate like this. You know, how many planes you can fly off, how many bombs it can carry before it has to be, you know, resupplied at sea. They carry, I think, we did it for World War II and I did it for How to Make War. It's several hundred bombing sorties. It's a fair amount. But before, that's now, because each of those, F-18s can carry, what, four bombs, eight bombs, or well, they can carry the, 16 or more of the 250-pound, smart bomb. So you can basically take out, you know, 10 times as many targets with smart bombs as you could 20 years ago with the, you know, the, even with the computer-assisted, you know, bombing site. And you can do it much more safely. You can do it from, you know, a distance away. These bombs also glide, and you can be at a very high altitude. So all of a sudden, without any change in the design of aircraft carriers, one aircraft carrier has become much more powerful.
Right.
It could win a war all by itself. It could never do that before. So even the Navy is acknowledging, you know, geez, these damn things are expensive.
Right. Now, what sort of missions would the Greenwater ships perform, Al?
Chasing pirates is a good example. I mean, right now we're trying to chase pirates with 7,000-ton destroyers that were designed to hunt submarines and shoot down airplanes. I mean, the Navy has almost no small ships. I think there's fewer than 20 small ships, you know, 1,000 tons or under.
And they keep trying to give them away.
And they keep trying to give them away. There's a handful of high-speed patrol craft, several hundred tons and crews about 35.
Just don't want O3s running a ship.
Yeah. And then there's a small number of minesweepers. Good story. When Katrina hit, you remember there was all this coverage of the Navy showing up?
Right.
And the President went and stayed on the, LPD or, one of the big amphibs.
Right.
Which were being used as the basing. What the Navy did was a number of, I think it was five or six minesweepers came up from the minesweeping base near Corpus Christi, and they did the work. Because Katrina was so horrendous, there were canals and rivers and ship channels, and you didn't know what was in them.
Yeah, I remember us running photos of those minesweepers going up the canals and the rivers.
They cleared several hundred miles of canal and river, but got no coverage, you know, because they're not glamorous looking like the big deck. And those are the kinds of missions that the small ships can do. And then, of course, you know, putting landing parties ashore, well, you know, hypothetically we can do it from submarines, but if you're in an area where the water's really shallow, well, I don't know if you can do it, you know. If you wanted to land a small reconnaissance force, for example, on Long Island, New York, you couldn't do it with a submarine because the water's so shallow, modern technology would find the submarine in a couple of minutes. But you could go in with a very small vessel that, you know, might go under the radar, so to speak. And then, of course, running up coasts and inlets and popping in on smugglers, which probably is something that the Navy doesn't want to do, but may have to at some point. So there's all these little missions that don't require a lot of people. But like in the Air Force, you know, if you fly the tanker, your chances of becoming a general are not as good as if you fly a fighter. Well, the same way in the Navy, if you're a destroyer man, your chances of becoming an admiral are a lot better than if you're commanding a little patrol boat running up rivers. In Vietnam, we had this enormous riverine force in the Navy, and I believe only one admiral ever came out of that.
And at least one senator.
And at least one senator, of course, yes. That was where the action was as far as the Navy was concerned. There were guys bucking to be in the swift boats and some of the other inshore operations, because that was where you could get shot at, you know.
It was the only war for the surface warfare guys. If you weren't an aviator, you weren't really fighting. You were just cruising around, you know, the South China Sea, you know, supporting the carriers. There is a constituency in the Navy for the brown water, you know, fight. The littoral, you know, combat ships are supposed to be equipped with a whole bunch of new robotic, you know, surface and subsurface, you know, devices. The surface robotic, which we've covered several times, the little surface craft, which are about the size of a, you know, a speedboat. But they basically can stay out there for, I think, 24 hours, some of them, patrol. They have day-night sensors, you know, all kinds of sensors and what have you. They have automatic control if they lose contact with their operator back in a surface ship or anywhere on the planet, actually, because they can do satellite feed. They will automatically go home, as it were, on their own. This is something that has some proponents in the Navy, but obviously it's going to be a generational shift because the carrier guys aren't going to give up easily. I mean, of course, the carrier guys are also fighting the robots. You know, it sounds like Battlestar Galactica. The Cylons are closing in from all sides. This is going to be another game changer because at that point, and this has already been brought up in the Navy and actually in the Air Force as well, it's the rise of the geeks.
Right.
Never mind Skynet. Worry about the programmers. Who the hell do you think built Skynet in the first place? I mean, they got that all wrong. and the guys who program this stuff, they're saying, hey, you know, we're the ones who are out there fighting. We're the ones who are basically, you know, making your tools, your implements of destruction. And we want to say, or otherwise we'll just go work for, you know.
For Atari. Right.
Yeah. And of course, as Jim pointed out, the robots, you know, are bothering the airmen too. This is another element in the call for, you know, the idea that we might be able to get by with fewer carriers, which is not new actually. The Navy, several people in the Navy have proposed it over the years. If you can put a portion of the, I mean, the carriers now have about 70 odd aircraft. If you can turn in a number of those for UAVs, you might be able to get back to 100 aircraft. And so now you have a choice. You'll still have manned aircraft there, because there are probably missions that will never be, or at least not within the foreseeable future, completely trusted to robots or remote control. But you know, if you've got 30 or 40 UAVs on an aircraft carrier, you can keep the same size carrier, or you can go for a smaller carrier.
Right.
Well, some people in the Navy has noticed that they've been carrying UAVs for decades, basically the cruise missile, and they quickly got used to that. Although the cruise missile is a one-way operation, but now they have cruise missiles which cruise around for a while, you know, under remote control, you know, looking for a target. And that, I think, has acclimated a lot of naval officers, at least the surface warfare guys, because they've been commanding flying robots. And in their way of thinking, you know, why not have more? The Navy has been flying the Scan Eagle UAV off the backs of the fantails of destroyers in the Gulf of Aden. And they've finally been testing on ships the new Scout, what they call it, the UAV helicopter, which was actually built for the Navy.
I have a funny story about that. Somebody tested that in New York City.
Oh, really?
Flew it off the roof of his house.
Fortunately,
one of the technicians, right, from a certain university. Fortunately, it was not noticed because it's relatively small.
It looks just like a manned helicopter, unless you get close.
Yeah, yeah.
It is a manned helicopter with the remote control replacing the cockpit.
Yeah, but anyway, that I mean that could have caused a panic very easily.
Yeah, if somebody got a picture of that, he would have been a big doo-doo.
Yeah. Well, probably nobody noticed it because of that gray paint scheme that they put on it. So,
yeah. And if you fly it high enough, you really can't tell that there's not a cockpit.
Right.
Because they just basically, there's no glass on it anymore. That's all fuel tank. It's just a damn thing can stay in the air for 8 hours.
Yeah.
Because the cockpit has been replaced with fuel and electronics. Well, but that's the future, and a lot of Navy guys are already comfortable with that, except the Navy guys who are comfortable with it are not the ones running the aircraft carriers.
Right.
That's where you're going to get your resistance, as Al points out.
Now, there's going to be a trickle-down effect as they shut down some of these aircraft carriers. That's going to mean that there's going to be a requirement for less destroyers, which is going to be say that we need less supply ships, et cetera, right?
Not necessarily. Go ahead, Al.
Yeah, not necessarily, because we still have the oceanic mission, and you're still going to need destroyers. You know, they call the submariners the silent service. Well, the Navy is a silent service. It doesn't get the PR. We could not have fought Korea, Vietnam,
Afghanistan,
Iraq. Well, not so much Iraq, but Afghanistan.
Well, especially Afghanistan now.
Yeah, yeah. You know, without the Navy. And the extent to which the Navy's role, for example, in Afghanistan, is overlooked is astonishing. I read an interview with Wolfowitz once during the Afghan campaign in 2001, and he was praising the Air Force. And he was, you know, he's talking about F-15s. Well, I mean, there was only one F-15 mission into Afghanistan, and that required a dozen refuelings and whatnot, and they operated from Kuwait. All of the tactical air missions were off the carriers.
Right.
And the smart bombs made it work.
Yeah. And meanwhile, this is a guy who should know better. And
right.
Didn't know. Which is rather astonishing. The Navy has not handled its PR well.
They've always been out there, let's face it. They've been at sea too long, you know, that makes you a little weird in the head.
Yeah. Well, there are some interesting sidebars to the fact that, in effect, the entire armed forces have been more or less deployed since 2001. Prior to 2001, I mean, the Navy was deployed most of the time. The Army and the Air Force were garrison forces. I mean, you know, they stayed home.
Yeah, all they had was the Balkans, and that wasn't much. They did have Iraq, but that was mostly Air Force.
Right.
So the Army had the Balkans, the Air Force had Iraq, and the Navy had the rest of the world.
Yeah, and so what you got was like really serious problems as we were going towards the joint business. Because Navy guys were finding it difficult to get their joint qualifications. You know, you have to go to a joint school and do a joint tour with a command and so on and so on. Well, now it's the Army and the Air Force are suddenly discovering that things are tight because of this need to keep those large forces forward. In fact, it was even more serious just, you know, like 2 or 3 years ago. So the Navy sort of benefited from that. And I think it's valuable that we have a Navy guy who's chairman now, because without the Navy, all of the missions that we're doing today would be totally impossible.
Right, especially from a logistics standpoint.
Yeah.
Now, the one thing is that we only have two LCS craft. The Independence has gone out to sea, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so we've got the Freedom and Independence. How many more are on the drawing board?
Well, that's a good question. The original plan was to have possibly as many as 50 of these, but the problem was that they grew. I mean, they were originally intended to be, you know, cheap ships that could operate in coastal waters with a lot of robotics and minimal manning and whatnot. And They've turned out to be fairly expensive.
They've capped the price at about half a billion, which may even hold, or 400 and some odd million. The current plan, as of a few months ago, was to build, I haven't got the numbers, we published this, was to build a few of the first one, the Freedom, the monohull, and they're going to be playing with the tri-hull, the 21st century one, as it were. And when they decide, they still plan on having 50 of them all together. But a lot depends on how well they hold up. I mean, they haven't gone out there and tried out the mission packages yet. There's a lot of potential there. I think, though, and Al, let me know if you agree or disagree with this, that the basic concept is correct. It's just surviving the media scrutiny long enough to get all the bugs out.
Yeah. And also the service squabbling and the constituencies. One of the things I've heard over and over again in monitoring military lists, you know, is, well, you can see what one harpoon missile can do to a small ship. Well, yeah, that's true. But you know, there's a cultural issue here. If I lose a ship, my career ends. If I'm a B-1 bomber pilot and I lose my plane, I get a medal. That B-1 bomber costs as much as my ship.
Several times as much as an LCS.
Yeah.
Hmm.
So that's a cultural thing. The risk aversion, guys like Halsey and whatnot would not have made it into World War II because they ran ships aground. But it was considered a...
training exercise, lessons learned.
Yeah, a hazard of the service, you know. Hey. I mean, well, you're doing everything correctly. Yes, okay. God bless you. You know, that's it. I mean, sure, you know, somebody might get sacked if he was doing something stupid. But, like the guy...
And we forget, after World War II started, there was a huge turnover in active, you know, naval officers with active commands. A lot of guys who were shining, you know, examples of naval officers in peacetime found themselves pushing a pencil somewhere after about 6 months because they just didn't have that get up and go
right.
that you need to win a war at sea.
Yeah, we have to accept risk if you're operating in the littoral areas. Now, we probably need something even smaller than LCS.
Is that where the high-speed vehicles fit in?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, they are. I visited one once. They are small. they're surprisingly comfortable. The normal crew is relatively small, but they can double the crew up. And even when the crew is doubled, the accommodations are no worse than they are in any current, you know, vessel. You know, like a compartment that holds two will hold four because they got two fold-down bunks, you know, above the existing bunks. But it's still a lot less cramped than submarine, which is unbelievable.
Is this the floating pup tent you're talking about?
The Swedish thing that we rented. I'm sorry, the Norwegian thing.
Oh, okay, no, but then there's the ship. I think they have it up for sale now. It looks like a pup tent gone to sea, but it's
that was the one that was used back in the 80s and was used by the research group, right?
Yeah, and it's still around.
Right.
But yeah, these high speed ships that the Scandinavians like this stuff because all they got to worry about is the Baltic. You know, those are fairly calm waters, and, you know, they're sheltered. But our Navy is obsessed with the high seas. You know, they just can't live with the fact that some ships you might have to carry on a container ship. That's to get through war. That just goes against their culture.
Right.
Yeah, well, we do that already.
And they hate it.
minesweepers operating in the Gulf region, go there by way of one of those big lifts, you know,
yeah.
the thing that put the coal back.
Yeah,
go
right.
there by way of
because it's just not worth it to have them try to make it under their own power.
Yeah.
It takes too long, and they get damaged.
Yeah, and also it means that the crew can stay home until the ship gets near there, and the crew can do other things like specialized training or advanced training or get their leave. Taken care of so that...
Those long transits really suck. When I was in the Army, I flew over to Korea, but when my time was up, they didn't value me as much, so they sent me back on a troop ship. And let me tell you, that's got to be the most boring thing, and I was going to get out of the Army at the end of the trip, so obviously I had something to be happy about. But these Navy guys, they did it all the time, and they didn't like it much better than we did. I mean, they adjusted, as one guy put it.
Yeah.
And, you know, a deck of cards and some porn, and they're happy. But, you know, it takes getting used to, and apparently even a lot of professional sailors, you know, never get completely used to it.
Right.
Well, look,
one of the reasons.
Go ahead, Al.
Yeah, well, I was going to say one of the reasons that the internet has become so popular in the fleet. I mean, you know,
yeah.
No longer isolated. Talk to your family in real time.
Right.
And the Navy had to be dragged into that kicking and screaming because they had to do it via satellite link, and the bean counters jumped all over that, and it took some convincing to make the bean counter realize the value of morale. You ever heard of the M word, sir?
Yeah.
It means a lot.
Well, it seems like this will be a continuing debate in the Navy then, and probably the one thing that's going to push it along towards the LCS is budget constraints, right?
Yeah. Can't afford, you know, $4 billion destroyers.
Right.
Yep.
All right. Well, thank you, gentlemen, and we'll talk to you next time.
Take care.
Okay.
Bye.